This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zelensky.
Tarun Shabra is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and also with the Center for Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown University. His research focuses on U.S. grand strategy, U.S.-China relations, and U.S. alliances. Tarun is a global expert on the implications of China's growing political and international influence. A Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford graduate, Tarun has served on the White House National Security Council and worked in the Pentagon. I caught up with Tarun for a chinwag and asked whether the US and China are already in a Cold War, how the US political system is responding to the China challenge, why democracies must work together to resist political warfare efforts from autocracies, and how the left should, in Tarun's words, play the China card. It's a really wide-ranging and fascinating chat, and I hope you take as much out of it as I did. Enjoy the episode. Tarun, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on, mate.
Thanks for having me, Misha.
And I say for the purpose of the recording, you're in Washington, D.C. I'm in Sydney. We're doing this via Zoom. So I appreciate having you on and giving us your time.
Great to be here.
Now, I thought a good place to start, it's a big conversation we could have, but you know, we're talking a lot about the US-China relationship globally. Curious about your take on what's caused a hardening of US attitudes to China. I mean, previously the view was that China, it was very much an engagement strategy, there'd be a peaceful rise. And now very much seen, certainly by the Trump administration, that China is a strategic rival. Curious for your take on that journey over the last 5 years in particular.
Yeah, thanks, Misha. So, you know, I think there are several components to it. The first, in my view, has been kind of a reckoning with China's integration into WTO, you know, a policy that, was introduced here in the 90s. And when it was introduced, as you may recall, you know, the promise was really that we would export goods and no jobs, quote unquote. And that was kind of a bipartisan commitment to the American people. And then fast forward to where we are now, and you have economists who estimate that, you know, anywhere between 2 and 4 million jobs were lost, mainly in manufacturing in the United States over that period, attributable to giving China permanent normal trading relations with the United States. And so I think that has really driven a lot of it. And it's not just the jobs lost, but it's what happened in the communities that were built around a lot of those companies, manufacturing, particularly in the Midwest. And as we all saw in 2016, this was a top line message by then candidate Trump. I think a second is the kind of the more assertive nature of the China's authoritarian regime. There's some debate, you know, about how much of this is really about Xi Jinping and how much of it is really about the character of the party. Xi just being the latest manifestation in the trajectory of the party. But, you know, in my view, you know, China's willingness to be somewhat flexible in the way that it operates, I've called it, you know, kind of a supple authoritarianism abroad, is in some ways more challenging than I think the ideological challenge posed by the Soviet Union, where the model was, you know, to adopt exactly the regime type in Moscow in many cases, the ability to co-opt elites, the ability to corrupt institutions, I think in many ways is a more daunting challenge. And we add to that the technology of mass surveillance. It's now available where China is a leading exporter of safe cities, surveillance technology, where the demand in many cases is there for a variety of reasons. But once you have it, it's going to be very hard to let it go. And you layer on to that China exporting its 5G infrastructure through Huawei. So I think kind of the totality of the challenge has become clear. And then as Australia has seen, you know, China's willingness to weaponize dependence on the Chinese economy, has become more and more clear. You all have seen it. The Norwegians have seen it. Certainly Korea and Japan have seen it. And, you know, just in the last week, we've seen now threats against the UK after its kind of recent turn, reconsidering its Huawei contracts for 5G. Now the threat is that any sort of cooperation, even on the nuclear side or on transportation, would be threatened as a result. So that kind of weaponization of interdependence, censoring free speech in many cases, has all kind of come to a head. You know, I think we're seeing the kind of apotheosis of it now in the COVID era. But you can look back at the record and kind of see that this was long coming.
And so you just touched on COVID. I mean, you've sort of detailed all the different areas of competition there, strategic competition, be it technological, economic, cultural, system of governance-based competition. How do you see, it's clear the tensions are much higher now post-COVID-19 outbreak. I mean, firstly, how do you expect those to play out? I mean, and secondly, who or which country system is more likely to benefit most from the disruption? Because, I mean, from an outside observer's point of view, it would seem that this is the first time that a global challenge hasn't been centrally led by the United States, and Donald Trump has deliberately chosen not to do that.
Yeah, and that's a pity. You know, I think there was a lot of debate early on in the crisis here. Some arguing that China was really poised to kind of take a leading role in the global order in the midst of COVID. Some people, you know, suggested this was kind of a Suez moment, even. And, you know, it's certainly possible that that could have happened in some ways, but as you know, China's conduct over the last couple months, has totally alienated, many populations and governments, right, where there might have been a real opportunity actually for them to kind of claim the mantle of leadership and show some even fleeting beneficence, but there's really been no sign of that. So, you know, over the long term, I think the key question really is how our economies emerge from this crisis. We continue not to really have a lot of fidelity on real growth and the record in the Chinese economy to some degree. So it's often kind of hard to predict that trajectory right now. But we certainly have our challenges right now. So I think it's the ball's really in the air right now. And there's some key decisions that we, the United States, need to make, many of our allies need to make, and that China's going to make, that could really, really make a big difference as to how we all emerge from this crisis.
And so, turning to sort of the domestic political debate on the China question, you've made the argument that the left should play the China card, in your words. Firstly, I mean, what do you mean by that, and why should the left do that? Because it's a vexed question for progressives on how to handle the rise of China, more so perhaps than it is for those that are more of the right.
Yeah. So I had a chance to work on this argument with a couple of co-authors, and you know, our view is that in general there's been a reluctance, often a well-grounded reluctance, for the left to kind of frame arguments in terms of geopolitical competition. And I think that comes from a, you know, concern that when you do that, you might lose control basically of the narrative and the politics that are related, and that you may risk both militarizing competition, spending more money on defense than you might wanted to otherwise, and that you risk kind of inflaming xenophobia. So those are kind of, I think the key kind of concerns from some folks on the left, and we see that now in some of the debate around how the Democratic presidential nominee now, Vice President Biden, should handle China in the course of the campaign. But our view has been that, and I guess this kind of turns on to some degree what your assumptions are about kind of the default politics, at least in the United States. And, you know, our view is that there's kind of a default libertarianism, and that historically the United States has tended to be more unequal, more divided at times when there has not been a geopolitical competitor, manages to make hard decisions and actually do things that progressives generally want in terms of national investment and civil rights when geopolitical competition requires it. We can dislike that, but we think it's an empirical reality. And so our argument is that progressives should embrace this frame, because many of the things that the United States needs to do when it comes to investment in education and infrastructure to really adopt major reforms, whether it comes to policing, which we're talking about now, and other things on civil rights and restoration of our kind of democratic fabric, all of that we might be able to do and build a bipartisan coalition for if we talk about these things based on concern about competition with China. And you know, we look to you know, some basically a change of heart on the part of some conservatives, particularly when it comes to economic thinking, where you have conservatives now who are saying maybe the United States does need an industrial policy in order to compete with China in certain sectors, which is, you know, really counter to conservative orthodoxy. And one would hope that we could build a coalition that would really broaden kind of the scope of domestic renewal and reform. I'll say that there's, you know, on the question about xenophobia, which is a really important one, you know, our view there is that if you, if progressives simply cede the ground to conservatives and it's in the United States and it's only one side that really owns the debate, that in many ways the risk is even greater that you know, xenophobic sentiments kind of get inflamed. And our view is that progressives should be able to own this debate and ensure that that does not happen, build credibility with the American public that they are more than capable and probably much even more capable in many cases of taking on China as a geopolitical competitor, and that we can do it while uniting the country and not dividing it.
And so you're sort of talking there kind of about the means and the ends, but I mean, how is it that, you know, one of the things that has become quite challenging in this debate with people is that whether or not democracies are capable now of delivering for people on domestic agendas, and China now holds up its model and the Chinese Communist Party holds up its model saying, you know, our system has lifted X hundred million people out of poverty. The United States is incapable of providing healthcare to its people. How can democracy and progressives sort of unite those arguments to make sure that systemically people have faith in that argument?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is the case. This, I mean, Misha, you just stated the case for progressive reform and why we should be talking about it in terms related to competition with China. I mean, you know, as progressives, we're going to continue to make the arguments that we've been making for a long time about why democracy needs to work for all of our citizens and not just those at the top. But the reality is that those arguments have not worked, certainly in the United States, for decades, which is why we find ourselves in this situation. And so, you know, if what it takes to get those who've opposed these kinds of reforms on board is to say the alternative is China championing its model around the world and showing that that system is just works for more people than democracy. If that's what it takes to get them on board, then we should be willing to make that argument.
And also, I think it's important to critique the regime and critique the regime for the behaviors that it displays, be it repression of people at home, be it breaking its word in the South China Sea, be it through coercive trade behavior. I think it's very important, to your point, that, you know, it would be a nonsense to not be able to critique the Chinese Communist Party because of the fact that it is Chinese, and that it's rather it's a critique of the behavior. And I think it's very important for progressives to own that. So I completely agree with you. Now, one of the things, you know, and this is a particular, it may not be relevant to the China piece, but it's certainly the question to the bipartisan piece in US politics. You know, your thesis that requires that there's a willing partner. So perhaps, you know, you've provided some examples where you'll get a policy outcome. Democrats may be doing it for a leftist ideal. Republicans are doing it for a conservative ideal, but the outcome is the outcome and it's good for the system. But is the Republican Party in its current iteration capable of reaching that kind of consensus? I think about, you know, the way that foreign policy has been politicized, either during the 2016 election, the collusion and interference, or even during the impeachment. I mean, what's your view there? I mean, do you have a hopeful case for that, or a slightly more pessimistic case?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a split right now within the Republican Party. There's broad consensus about, you know, at a rhetorical level, about the need to kind of confront China on a lot of issues, and that sentiment is shared also by a lot of Democrats. Where I think on the right in the United States, the breakdown happens is you still do have a lot of folks who are faithful to kind of conservative orthodoxy and believe that government is always the enemy and really should not have a role, particularly in economic issues. And you know, my view is that this kind of ignores a lot of history about innovation and technology development in the United States in particular. You know, if you read a book like Margaret O'Meara's about, you know, the birth of Silicon Valley, I mean, the role of the U.S. government and just the Defense Department is enormous. And even if you look at, you know, through the 1980s, you know, the largest employer was Lockheed Martin. It was not Apple or others, even at that stage. And so I think that debate is roiling right now within the Republican Party. And it's only roiling because of China. It's only roiling because they see that we don't have a U.S. competitor who can integrate a 5G network, and that we have to look abroad and we have to kind of build a coalition now. And the reason that happened is that as China was kind of ramping up support for its own industry, just to take 5G, for example, and providing finance from its policy bank so that it's that Huawei would be adopted around the world, US and other Western companies were basically withering on the vine in the face of that kind of massive subsidy, essentially. So I think that debate continues. I'm hopeful though that there are enough people in the Republican Party who could join progressives in the kind of agenda that we're talking about. It doesn't have to be the whole party, but there needs to be a caucus and a coalition.
And so turning to the Democratic Party, I mean, curious to your take on where it currently sits on the China question, because I mean I think some people seem to take the view that, I mean, there's a lot of bipartisanship when it comes to this strategic competition piece, but a lot of people seem to think that Trump's critique issues with behaviors that have been undertaken for all the ones that you've listed by the Chinese Communist Party are correct, but his mechanism of dealing with it are incorrect. So, I mean, I'm kind of curious for your take on that. But for example, like, had Hillary Clinton have won the election, would she have been just as tough to your mind, even if not a little more conventional in her approach?
Thanks so much. Yeah. So I think a turn was inevitable. And, you know, even if you go back and look at the last couple years of the Obama administration, particularly the last year, you know, work done on artificial intelligence, on semiconductors, there was really a turn that was already happening. would a Clinton administration have looked just like a Trump administration on China policy? No, I don't think that we would have seen the trade war unfold as it has. I think there's a key question that often goes, under noticed about, assumptions that we make about the Chinese economy. And so, in some ways you could argue that what Trump has done is, while it appears to be discontinuous with some of his predecessors because of the tariffs, on the other hand, the kind of underlying theory of the case for Trump is that we would go from phase one, which was about basically purchases and mainly of agriculture in the United States, to a phase two, where we would get the Chinese to implement meaningful structural reform of their economy. So essentially, his argument and his administration's argument was, we can get China to change. We can get them to change the way they subsidize their businesses. We can get them to change the way they've done forced technology transfer and IP theft for decades. And I think that's just a wrong assumption. And I think the better assumption really is that they're not going to change anytime soon because it's worked too well for them. And the key question for us is, what are we going to do in terms of domestic investment and cooperation with our allies to respond to it? I think a change was coming, but frankly, that assumption needed to really change, and it hasn't under the Trump administration.
Well, it's interesting. So one of the things I'm curious about is, one of the critiques tends to come from progressive people in politics, but also from the business community, certainly in Australia. Is it possible to be more cooperative with the Chinese Communist Party? I mean, some people say, well, if only the US was nicer in the way it approached matters, or if Australia didn't sort of make comment about a COVID-19 investigation, or if we allowed China to invest in our 5G network, that the relationship would be fine. And so essentially that the offence caused is always on the European side, or the American side, or the other Asian nation sides that are in the South China Sea debate. So, I mean, what is it possible to cooperate, or do you think that's a false construct?
Well, I think the way that it's sometimes framed is not productive. So I think that the traditional framing of this of kind of interdependence fostering more stable relations, I think doesn't hold up now. I mean, we've seen that's not the way that Beijing sees this. The way Beijing sees it is dependence fostering ways to enhance their coercive power. In some ways, I think we need to think about interdependence needing to line up with some symmetry of interests. And to the degree that those interests diverge, I think too much interdependence actually makes the relationship much more unstable. Yes, there certainly will be areas, right, where we'll find opportunities and we'll need to cooperate with the Chinese. I mean, we're not going to be able to deal with climate change unless there's some sort of more meaningful action by China. We could have seen a world in which pandemic response was done in a more cooperative fashion, and we're not yet at the vaccine stage, so we'll see how this goes. But it's not looking like that's going to be a particularly cooperative enterprise at this stage, given the way this is unfolding right now. But I think what we need to think about is, what are the mechanisms by which we get to some sort of cooperation? And I think too often when we say cooperation, we think that means there'll be some sort of comedy. I think instead we may get quote unquote cooperation when we think about a much broader toolkit, including deterrence, stop doing certain things, and some degree of coercion in some cases to get China to cooperate on a certain set of issues. So I think we need to kind of disentangle and sift through what we mean by cooperation in particular spheres. But one thing I think we really have to be careful about, and I think we saw this a little bit during the Obama administration, was when there were areas where we felt we needed or wanted Chinese cooperation on transnational issues, whether that was climate change or non-proliferation issues, that often Beijing saw that as an opportunity for leverage, opportunity to get us to do other things or at least be silent when they were doing other things. So if you look at that, you know, period toward the end of the Obama administration, you know, we saw the entire human rights bar of lawyers in China totally decimated. You know, we saw the beginnings of what was beginning to happen in Xinjiang right now. So this turn, I think, really began.
You mean with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. The internment of, you know, more than a million Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities there. But Beijing, I think, believing that in order to get them to cooperate on climate, in order to get them to go around with the Iran deal, that they could essentially buy, you know, America's silence and that of many other countries as well. And so what we have to do, I think, is to kind of be very clear that we're not going to be trading these things off. We're going to have to separate these issues. And if China doesn't want to take meaningful steps on climate to the degree that we really need to do it, which is another issue that progressives or leaders on and rightly care about a lot, we're going to need to think about ways to kind of put pressure on the regime to get them to do the right thing on climate. And, you know, we've done this in micro fashion where, you know, the U.S. Embassy was advertising the air quality in Beijing. But we need to make the case to the Chinese people about the delta between what China is doing now on climate and where that's going to go, what that's going to mean for China's coastal cities, for example. We should be leading the charge on making that case clear and why China needs to do more.
And so you sort of touched on the debate internally. I'm curious about where you see the debate currently playing out in the Democratic Party. I mean, firstly, how did it play out in the primaries? I mean, because clearly President Trump wants to make this an election issue and he's targeting a presumptive candidate in Biden on this. So what do you see the politics of that, firstly, within the Democratic Party, and how do you see this playing out in a general?
Yeah, so I think you're seeing, you know, just as we've discussed some of the debate in the Republican Party, you know, we've got debate within the Democratic Party too, and it's unfolding on the op-ed pages now of the Washington Post and the New York Times. And, you know, one line of the debate is, you know, whether Vice President Biden should make a tough position on China, a central kind of tenet of his campaign. He has decided to do so. I think for good reasons. But you have some Democrats and some who lean Democrat basically arguing that is dangerous. The basis for their argument, you know, ranges from, you know, that will induce xenophobia. That's certainly one. Another is that this shouldn't be the subject of democratic and political debate because, you know, I find this one a little bit hard to understand because it's such a critical issue. I think it should be front and center for democratic deliberation. But essentially that it's kind of too sensitive or it will box in a Biden administration. Again, I find that one hard to understand. And then again, others who say that this kind of will lead to a militarization frame and again, defense spending or kind of commitments to U.S. force posture abroad that they find unsustainable or potentially kind of risking conflict. I think that's a healthy debate to have. We should have it. And there's certainly a healthy debate in terms of thinking about where we should be investing in long-term competition with China and the degree to which I know we should be focusing on technology and economics as kind of the locus of competition to some degree. But But I think, you know, the vice president seems to have kind of made a decision already on this question. And so we'll kind of see to what degree I think those who have not liked that message find ways to kind of, you know, as we were talking about earlier, latch onto the argument to support some of the causes that I think progressive causes that they do support. And so I hope that we can kind of mend some of that and build a coalition with them within the Democratic Party, but then also with Republicans as well on some of the reforms and investments that we desperately need.
So, I mean, it sounds, I mean, any sort of fair-minded observer would say, would assume that, you know, strategic competition at a minimum, irrespective of whichever party is in control of either the White House or the Houses of Congress is here to stay. But, you know, is it, are we at the point now, some people have said that it's a new Cold War. Some people have said it's like a 1.5 Cold War. It's not Cold War 2.0. But, I mean, Vice President Pence gave a speech a little over a year or two ago. Essentially, some people have concluded that that was the beginning of a new Cold War. I mean, what's your view? Are we in one? Is it inevitable that there will be one?
You know, this is it a Cold War? Is it not a Cold War? Has become, I think, kind of a shibboleth for a separate debate about you know, to what degree we should, you know, pursue competition and to what degree we should try to maintain some degree of engagement. And I think the on the Cold War question per se, I think we should be looking to the Cold War for some lessons, because it was the last time the United States was engaged in strategic competition with another great power. So there are things that we can learn from the Cold War that are applicable, but it's obviously different in many other ways, because we didn't have the degree of commerce that we do have with China, nor did U.S. allies have that degree of commerce with the Soviet Union as they do today. So we have to account for that, obviously. So I think in general, I don't have the allergy that I think a lot of people have to talking about the Cold War in this context, because there are really important lessons. You know, if you've just in the last, you know, few months, I've been, you know, because I mainly now work on kind of technology competition, you know, the lessons from some Cold War export controls still remain, I think, pretty valid. The alliance management challenges that we face today together with our allies, I think some of those remain relevant as well. But again, I think in some ways, as we were discussing earlier, some aspects of competition with China are going to be more intense than they were with the Soviet Union. I think that's particularly the case on the ideological front for some of the reasons we talked about, whether it's China being more flexible, or the technology and surveillance component to this competition. So again, I think, is it a Cold War? Is it not a Cold War? I think is less helpful than what lessons can we learn from the Cold War, and what's different about this competition.
And so, you know, you've talked a lot about competition, and, you know, one of the phrases now that's in vogue is this concept of decoupling, and, you know, essentially, which is, you know, to what degree should countries be sovereign in their supply chain integrity, particularly when you talk about technology. And China's made no secret, well, China's notorious for its IP theft in some instances, or certainly in its aggressive approach to IP transfers and its trade practices. But I mean, to what extent do you, how can the US and other democracies structure their economies and their technological investments to compete with a much more monolithic structure in the Chinese state, but at the same time, it's more of a hybrid than what we saw with the Soviet Union, which didn't have the same economic firepower that the West had in the previous Cold War?
Yeah. So, you know, in the current context, obviously concerns about the medical supply chain and, you know, pandemic resilience are driving some push toward decoupling slash reshoring. We've also had in the U.S. an ongoing review by the Pentagon about defense supply chains and concerns there about resilience in the event of not just conflict, but some sort of spat that results in China cutting off certain supply chains as well. So that's certainly there, and those concerns are going to persist. But I think the thing that we often don't pay enough attention to is that the biggest driver of decoupling is China. It's China's own decoupling drive. So if you look at, China's ambitions when it comes to artificial intelligence, or you look at the Made in 2025 plan, if you look at their 2035 standards plan, and now, and you can say some of this, or at least that push for decoupling by China is being driven to some degree by export controls that we put in place as well. It certainly had been accelerated. That's probably fair to say. But that's the major driver here, is China's own, what they call the indigenization drive when it comes to key technologies. China does not want to be interdependent with the United States or other countries when it comes to key technologies in particular. So I think we need to some degree, really focus on China's drive toward decoupling and figure out what we, the United States, and we as an alliance want to do in this window, which I think really is a window, because it's a window in which the CCP has clearly stated their intentions. They're clearly making massive investments in talent and kind of technological and industrial capacity, but they still don't have the ability to kind of achieve all of those, I'd say somewhere on the order of 10 to 20 years. So what do we want to do in that window? What are our strategic objectives? And can we come up with a plan as an alliance to kind of handle that? And I think kind of some of the navel gazing over shall we decouple or shall we not, I think is beside the point. It's really not fully kind of comprehending where China is headed and how we have to respond to it.
Do you think there's a role for allied supply chains? Some people have written about this concept that, because I think people either frame this debate now as essentially you either produce domestically or you rely on global supply chains, which are, a vast majority of production currently, certainly industrial production occurs in the PRC. But, is there a role for allied supply chains or trusted partners in that context?
Absolutely. I think there has to be. I mean, there will be some industries that the United States will want to reshore to the United States. I think, that's going to be the case, I think, with a lot of countries when it comes to medical supply chains, because I think the degree to which we were kind of totally dependent on, some kind of emergency supplies, I think wasn't clear, especially to a lot of politicians and legislators, until the COVID pandemic. So some of that will be reshored to the United States, and many other countries, I think, will be doing the same thing. But more broadly on technology issues, if you look at the semiconductor industry, for example, the United States cannot do this and should not do it alone. I mean, there is news of a new fab potentially built by TSMC, Taiwan's major semiconductor manufacturing company, moving to Arizona. But if you look at the broader supply chains around semiconductors, Japan and Korea, the Netherlands are all key players here. And I think we should think of, not only do we need to accept that reality and kind of embrace it, but also think about ways of embedding allied supply chains as kind of also strengthening alliance ties, which I think are going to be critical, because we need them not just when it comes to technology, but we need them on a broader array of economic issues, and we need them on defending human rights and protecting free speech. And so I think the deeper that these ties can be, the better. So we should think about this in the context of a broader alliance management really, you know, kind of, I think, focus on in particular sectors where, again, Beijing's ambitions, intent are very clear. What is our long-term plan, and particularly what is our plan in this window before China can actually achieve domestic capacity?
And so you sort of touched a lot there on working together. I mean, one of the distinctions, perhaps distinctions might be the wrong way of putting it, but it's one of the characteristics of the Trump presidency has been, pulling, apart from the Chinese Communist Party, pulling autocrats closer and pushing away friends and allies, and what's traditionally been a position of US leadership in multilateral institutions. I mean, do you think it's possible that we're going to see a world where that no longer has coordinating institutions? We've seen attacks on the World Health Organization. Certainly, the UN is not nearly as effective in settling disputes as it was. China's made it clear it doesn't respect rulings from The Hague. I mean, how do you see the role of coordinating institutions in this sort of more ideologically competitive world?
We need them. And I think that the way that the US should be thinking about these institutions is that they are another forum in which the US has got to compete, hopefully together with its allies, against China, because that's certainly the way the China sees them. So, you know, the WHO is a good example here, particularly as COVID impacts developing countries, countries that don't have the health systems that the United States or Australia, many other allied countries have. We desperately need a functioning WHO, but we need one that is independent and that has integrity and is not pushed around by China. And you know, I think the right way to kind of handle the early days of this crisis would have been to be actively engaged with the WHO, doing a lot of the diplomacy with international organizations that we've been doing across parties for decades, where you were kind of vigorously engaged and ensuring that no one is pushing their particular country's interests over our own. And I think there could have been a different path for the WHO in this if there had been much more vigorous engagement with the WHO, pushing them not to kind of do what they did, which was, you know, parrot some lines out of Beijing about human-to-human transmission, for example, or how well Beijing was doing in the early days. As we've seen with some great investigative reporting over the last just week or so, there was a lot of concern internally at the WHO, and I think a lot of them were probably looking for allies who didn't necessarily want to do what China was pushing them to do. So I just bring that up because that's obviously a very kind of live example, but this is across the board. And, I think to some degree in the United States, particularly, on the right, we still, there's this ideological kind of baggage from the 1990s when multilateral organizations were seen to be purely, a constraint on American power, and really not doing much else. Obviously, you know, the historical legacy of ambivalence toward multilateralism goes back even further with the United States through the 20th century. But I think that period of the 1990s, that this kind of ideological antagonism toward international institutions was really hardened. And you would think that it would be updated in the context of competition with China, because China's seen this as an opening where the U.S. pulls out, China goes in, exercises a very different kind of influence. And our allies, obviously, very frustrated by it, understandably. So I would hope that whatever happens in 2016, that that we have much more vigorous engagement with multilateral institutions, and that we build coalitions again with our allies to kind of push back on some of the more malign Chinese influence in these places.
And so, you talked a lot about allies, democracies working together. An idea that's certainly gained some currency now. I mean, it seems that around the world, gradually, most democratic nations are starting to realize that there's a competition here between systems, between the Chinese Communist Party's model of autocratic technocracy and technological sort of monolithic approach to things at home. And then increasingly that sort of domestic tension between trading with China and being friendly with China is very difficult to manage. Do you see any currency in this idea being pushed of a so-called D10, which has come out of this, Britain somewhat belatedly has now decided that they don't want Huawei participating, it would seem, in their 5G rollout. I'm kind of curious, they've been sort of now pushing this idea of D10 of the world's top 10 democracies coordinating actions together. Is there a role for that, or is that too overt?
You know, I think there's definitely room for that sort of mechanism. You know, I generally think that we're going to have to be flexible in the kinds of arrangements that we have, and that there may be kind of a variety of coalitions of democracies on different issues. And that might make it easier for some countries that are reluctant to be seen as participating in a quote unquote anti-China coalition. But if we meet together where we in one format to focus on 5G issues, we meet in a different one to focus on semiconductors, and we meet in other contexts to kind of push back on what China's done to the human rights regime globally. I think that's all healthy, and we should be doing it. I think that's the right way of thinking about the problem. But in terms of whether that's going to be the sole institution or not, I'm less sure. And I guess I'm just trying to be realistic about it, because we've seen this with the Quad, and you know this better than anybody else. You know, getting the various countries to show up to a Quad meeting and settling the agenda can often be challenging because of the perception that, by doing that, it's explicitly some sort of anti-China coalition.
Or so a containment strategy.
Exactly.
Japan, India, Australia, and the United States.
Exactly. Whereas if you are kind of meeting in multiple fora and just engaging in your business, there may be less concern about that. I think the issue is less about whether there is this one discrete forum, and more about whether we build kind of a worldview, build a consensus about what the basic things are that we need to be doing together. I guess I'm maybe too hopeful, but I see signs, particularly because China's behaved so badly during the COVID crisis, of that turn really happening now. We see it kind of building constituencies in parliament. We have this new interparliamentary working group on China issues. We kind of see pushback to some of China's behavior, kind of developing more of a domestic political valence. So I think the opportunities to do this are actually much better than they were. I shudder to think of what would have happened if Xi Jinping had decided to hide and bide a little bit longer, if they had not gone on the offensive they've gone on over the last several years, and particularly during the COVID outbreak. I think we could really be up a creek. So I hope we can seize some of the momentum and kind of channel it into some productive and affirmative cooperation among allies.
Yeah, I share your views there. Certainly, for those that are critics of the Chinese Communist Party, they've certainly been validating a lot of those critiques over the last few years, certainly. So, kind of, you know, just on that topic, I mean, the real big challenge, and I'm curious to get your take on this, is it's between autocracies and democracies, but it's also between open and closed systems. I'm very much curious about how, you know, what was different about the Cold War was that the systems were in competition, but they were separate. And we have this codependence, this interrelationship, and what it's done is created a number of areas where foreign interference can occur and so-called gray zone interference can occur, because there are so many different leverage points that exist and so many touch points that exist between both systems. But there's no reciprocity. And what I mean by that, of course, is, autocratic regimes, due to the openness of a democratic nation, can meddle through the various different ways, through information or through finance or through trade or what have you, in a way that you just can't do. You can't even Google the Tiananmen Square massacre if you're in mainland China. So how can open systems prevail in that contest? You know, because traditionally the view was openness would win. You know, Bill Clinton said good luck controlling the internet, famously. Yeah. Like nailing jello to a wall, I think he said. But it seems that they are winning at this point in that struggle.
Yeah. So I think the trajectory of that, right, doesn't look bright, in the sense that with the export of a lot of Chinese technology now, surveillance technology, and potentially the synergy between that and having Huawei as your 5G network would suggest that the potential for control, kind of digital authoritarianism, as it's been called, has only intensified and is being exported around the world. I think we have to kind of focus on our strengths as open societies. We've got to be able to show through example, what our societies are about. And that's what's so troubling about what's happening in the United States right now, is we certainly are not, we're not demonstrating anything by example right now, whether it's in the administration's response to the protest movement, or the response to COVID. But I think we can, again, and I don't think necessarily that authoritarian societies or the CCP even has fully thought through what all the implications are of following through on their ambitions for surveillance. One could imagine a lot of situations in which those systems could go wrong. They could go sideways in a lot of ways that could generate a lot of public discontent and potentially unrest. Just imagine a social credit system, blocking an entire class of people or from accessing vital services, for example. One can imagine a lot of ways in which it could go sideways that I don't think they've fully thought through. So I guess I don't see this as kind of a binary where the question has been decided. I think it's going to be a competitive experiment here, where the authoritarian vision for technology and surveillance seems to be, it's being adopted widely in many cases now, but we haven't really kind of seen it fully roll out and seen all the potential vulnerabilities that are inherent to it.
Do you think there's a case for democracies to be more assertive in their responses to sort of interference efforts? So it's, over the last few years, it's tended to be one-way traffic. If it's from the Russians meddling with the United States election or with Brexit and other European elections, or if it's with the Chinese Communist Party interfering in various democracies around the country, around the world, including Australia. I mean, is there a case for more assertive foreign policy approach to responding to that?
Yeah, I think there has to be. I mean, I think it was reported that the administration of the United States kind of took some measures against the Internet Research Agency in Russia, probably led by the U.S. Cyber Command, to kind of disable their for a period of time in response to some of the political interference. And I think that's been, General Nakasone, who runs Cyber Command and National Security Agency, has talked about this as a policy of quote unquote persistent engagement. And I think that is the kind of way that we're going to need to engage some of these operations. And I would be surprised if we didn't see similar reactions to some of the Chinese disinformation around COVID, and then potentially around some of the protests, even as well, because I think for those who've been seeing Chinese information operations and around Taiwan, around countries in the region, I think many of us have believed that it was only a matter of time before that started coming to the United States as well, and hitting other allies. And I think it's happening now, and I don't think it's going to be going anywhere.
Well, we could talk about this for a very long time, but I know that your time is short. So I'll, as ever, make my very clunky segue to the final question, the much beloved stupid question that I ask all my guests about barbecues and who you'd have and why. It's always sort of interesting to me, so I ask it. Australia and the United States clearly have a very long and deep relationship. But I was wondering who the three Australians, alive or dead, would be at a barbecue at Tarula. they all can't be Crocodile Dundee, mate. I'm sure you'll be madly Googling if I asked you.
All right, let me see. When I was just out of college, I had a chance to work at the UN with on a commission. I was a junior staffer for this commission of very important people, and one of them was Gareth Evans, actually. So I'm very fond of Gareth. So I put
our former Australian foreign minister in the Labor government. So it's
exactly. So Gareth is always a great barbecue dinner companion. So I put Gareth there, thinking a lot about the protest movement going on right now. I recall that I had a grade school teacher who, taught us about civil rights movements around the world. And so I've always admired your civil rights leader, Faith Bandler, who's involved in your 1967 referendum, and a key player there. And I'm a big fan of Australian wine, so maybe we could add Max Schubert, your kind of master winemaker.
Well, that's who's bringing the booze, I suppose, to the barbecue. All right, well, mate, thank you so much for your time, Tarun, and look forward to catching up with you in the future, mate.
Thanks, Misha, for having me. It was great to chat with you.
Cheers. G'day Diplomates fans, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Ross. It was a fantastic chat. If you haven't done your homework yet, grab your phone out of your pocket, don't put it off any longer, open up iTunes, open up your favorite podcasting app, leave a 5-star review for the show. It makes a huge difference. It takes 5 seconds of your time, but it makes a great big difference to the promotion of the show. Believe it or not, you can make a huge difference to spreading the word of the Diplomates podcast, and I'd really appreciate your help. I hope you enjoyed the episode. See you next time. Bye for now.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.